Our next speaker is Dr. Brad Wilcox. Dr. Wilcox is director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia. He is associate professor of sociology at the University of Virginia and a member of the James Madison Society at Princeton University. Dr. Wilcox's research focuses on marriage and cohabitation and on the ways that gender, religion, and children influence the quality and stability of American family life. He's published articles on marriage, cohabitation, parenting, and fatherhood in the American Sociological Review, Social Forces, the Journal of Marriage and Family, and the Journal of the Scientific Study of Religion. His first book, Soft Patriarchs, New Men, How Christianity Shapes Fathers and Husbands, examines the ways in which religious beliefs and practices of American Protestant men influence their approach to parenting, household labor, and marriage. He came to my personal attention through his 2010 report, When Marriage Disappears, The New Middle America, which exposes the retreat from America, the retreat from marriage, more properly spoken, which is happening in middle-class America. But this afternoon, Dr. Wilcox will enlighten us regarding the role that gender plays in parenting. So I invite you to come forward.
Thanks, Derek, for that kind introduction. I find myself in a curious position. I travel the world from Montevideo to Marrakesh, from Warsaw to Washington, from Bogota to Ottawa, to offer a social scientific perspective on the family. I rely upon large-scale surveys, statistical models, and peer-reviewed studies to convey important truths about marriage and family life. But virtually everything I have to say is what would have been considered common sense by my grandma. That is, I'm in the business of using elaborate social science to prove grandma right. So, okay. Alas, every day we seem to be less and less inclined to listen to the wisdom of grandma. Take California last August. At the beginning of that month, San Francisco Judge Von Walker struck down California's marriage law and declared in his legal opinion that it's beyond any doubt that parents' genders are irrelevant to children's developmental outcomes. I think grandma would beg to differ. The silliness from California continued later in the month when Hollywood star Jennifer Aniston, who was then starring in a movie about a woman who uses a sperm donor to have a baby, said the following. She said, quote, "Women are realizing that they don't have to settle with a man just to have that child," unquote. I don't think grandma would agree that having a sperm donor for a daddy is a good idea. More generally, though, these two quotes are indicative of a new elite wisdom that is taking hold in much of the Americas, including Canada. The new elite wisdom is that all kinds of families are just as good as the intact married family for children, and that mothers and fathers do not make distinctive contributions to the emotional, the social, and the financial welfare of their kids. Now, regardless of this elite wisdom, a large and growing body of social science indicates that mothers and fathers bring distinctive talents to the parenting enterprise, that children are most likely to thrive and even survive when they're raised by their own mother and father, that kids long to know and be known by the man and woman who brought them into this world. In other words, it's not just gender differences that matter to kids, it's being in relationship to their own biological father and mother. So in light of these basic ideas, let me now take you on a kind of tour de force of the science regarding gender and parenthood. We're going to start with moms. Of course, among the many distinctive talents that moms bring to the parenting enterprise, four stand out. Breastfeeding, understanding their children, communicating with their children, and nurturing their children. Obviously, only mothers can breastfeed their kids. At least maybe we'll see something different in a few years. But at least right now, only moms can breastfeed their kids. And of course, breastfeeding is time-consuming and our contemporary world often inconvenient. But most mothers, once they kind of make sense of it, get a sort of, you know, get it down, find breastfeeding both physically pleasurable and emotionally rewarding. There are also clear health benefits for mothers who breastfeed, which is a marked reduction in the risk of breast cancer. As importantly, the medical literature on the advantages of breastfeeding could not be clearer. Breast milk offers infants a range of sugars, nutrients, and antibodies that are unavailable in infant formula. Breastfeeding protects infants against at least 15 serious maladies, from ear infections to sudden infant death syndrome or SIDS. Most importantly, I think, breastfeeding helps to cement the biological foundations of the unique mother-child bond that lasts into and beyond adolescence. So clearly, mothers have a very sex-specific advantage in parenting when it comes to breastfeeding. When it comes to parenting, mothers build on this biological foundation to excel in interpreting the physical cues of their children. Mothers are more responsive to distinctive cries of infants. They're better able than dads, for instance, to distinguish between a cry of hunger and a cry of pain from their baby. They're also better than dads at detecting the emotions of their children by looking at their faces, postures, and gestures. One experiment found, for instance, that women are better than men at identifying infant emotions such as sadness, fear, surprise, or joy. Another study found that teenagers report that mothers know them better and are more in tune with their moods compared to dads. Dr. Marian Legato, who directs the Partnership for Gender-Specific Medicine at Columbia University, believes biology has primed women to read nonverbal cues of infants. She writes, quote, "Women have to be better at reading the subtle and nuanced language of human expression compared to men, so they can better determine the needs of their highly dependent, wordless infants," unquote. As kids age into adolescence, moms typically retain this advantage. So in sum, compared to fathers, mothers are better able to read their children's actions and appearances to determine their emotional and physical state. Moms also have an advantage when it comes to communicating with their kids. They use more words and more descriptive words with their children. They can interpret the tone and content of their children's utterances better than men. And they remember what their kids actually say better than fathers do. I can certainly attest to all these things personally. For instance, moms are better at detecting whether an ambiguous comment, "You and Dad sure seem concerned about my grades," is meant to be ironic, critical, or complimentary. Now, what is it? And there, I think there are social reasons, but I think there are also biological reasons here. And I'll just mention three. Number one, women have more nerves in the left brain, which is the seat of our ability to process language compared to men. Women's left and right brains also enjoy more connectivity than do men's. That is, the corpus callosum, the network of fibers connecting the left and the right brains, is larger in women's brains than it is in men's brains. Women also have more dopamine in the part of the brain responsible for language and memory skills. Dopamine is a chemical messenger that helps deliver information efficiently within the brain. Once again, as Dr. Legato from Columbia says, she says, quote, "The increased accessibility of these biological systems make listening to, understanding, and producing speech easier for women," unquote. And once again, as someone who lives with one woman and four girls, I can attest to the truth of Dr. Legato's insight about women's advantage in this department. So this maternal sensitivity to children helps explain why mothers are superior when it comes to nurturing the young, especially infants and toddlers. Because they excel in reading their children, they're better able to provide their kids with what they need, from a snack to a hug, when they're in some type of distress. Perhaps more importantly, there is considerable sociological and psychological evidence that mothers are more emotionally attached to their kids than are fathers. So the point is that mothers seem to be more invested in responding to their children's immediate needs, and fathers are more likely to give their kids a measure of latitude. Well, why is this? Well, it's in part because of the biological evidence that moms are primed by their hormones to engage in nurturing behavior like hugging, praising, or cuddling. We know, for instance, that women have markedly higher levels of estrogen compared to men, and estrogen is known to promote nurturing behavior in humans. The hormone oxytocin, which is released at high levels in women during pregnancy and breastfeeding, makes mothers more interested in bonding with children and engaging in nurturing behavior compared to dads. In other words, not only are women better at nurturing, but they also seem to draw more satisfaction from expending time and energy nurturing kids, one thing, particularly younger children. And kids know this, they intuit this. Numerous studies indicate that infants and toddlers prefer their moms compared to their dads when they're seeking solace or relief from hunger, fear, sickness, or some other distress. Mothers tend to be more soothing. For instance, one study done at Boston Children's Hospital found that infants relaxed when moms approached. Their pulse, their breathing rates, their eyelids all lowered when mom came into the picture. So in other words, when children look for comfort and consolation, no one compares to mom. So for all these reasons, it should come as no surprise to find that, as Stanford psychology professor Eleanor Maccabee has observed, quote, in all known societies, women, whether they're working outside the home or not, assume most of the day-to-day responsibility for childcare. Or as Rutgers anthropologist Helen Fisher has said, in every culture in the world where anthropologists have looked, in 168 societies, even where women are exceedingly economically powerful, women do the vast majority of the raising of the very small children. Women are interested in babies. They bear the babies. They've got high levels of estrogen associated with the nurturing of the very young, unquote. Then, of course, this point echoes the point we heard about even Sweden, where women dominate the paid provision of childcare. So taken together, mothers' comparative advantage in breastfeeding, understanding their kids, communicating with their children, and nurturing makes it logical for societies to organize the bulk of childrearing around the mother. And this is indeed what we see in countries ranging from Spain to South Africa, from India to England, and from Colombia to Canada. Although the distinctive talents that mothers bring to the childrearing enterprise are invaluable, especially for infants and toddlers, fathers also bring an array of distinctive talents to the parenting enterprise. I'm going to focus here on five advantages that dads bring to family life when it comes to providing, discipline, play, challenging their kids to embrace life's challenges and opportunities, and then finally, loving the mother of their children. Now, the first point that I want to make here is that money actually matters, and that we talk about parenting in the academy and in the media, often we, I think, forget this basic reality, this basic truth, that money matters for families when it comes to things like food, clothing, housing, and education, and that at least in intact married families, it's still the case that dads are more likely to focus more on this providership dimension than are women. They work more hours typically after kids come along, whereas wives tend to work fewer hours after kids come along. And that in the U.S. at least, it's still the case that about two-thirds of household income in married families is brought in by the father. So clearly here, fathers make a real material contribution to the welfare of their family, one that we should not forget and that we should not minimize. The second point is that although mothers actually discipline their kids more often, which they have more instances of discipline with their kids because they spend more time with their kids, dads do have a comparative advantage in this area. Typically, dads engender more fear than mothers in their children because of their comparative physical strength and size, along with the pitch and inflection of the voice of the father. All these things can telegraph toughness to kids. So compared to moms, dads are more assertive in their dealings with their children, and they're less likely to bend family rules or principles for their kids. In a word, dads tend to be firmer and more compelling disciplinarians than mothers. This may be linked in part to, for instance, differences in testosterone. You know, insofar as testosterone is associated with things like strength, voice, you know, dominance, and whatnot. But for whatever reason, whether it's biological or social or some combination thereof, fathers are more likely than mothers to get their kids, particularly their teenage sons, to respond appropriately to their disciplinary strategy, both because of their uniquely firm approach to discipline and because boys seem more likely to respond to discipline from someone of the same sex. For all these reasons, then, dad's discipline plays a signal role in fostering an orderly climate in the home. Dads also have an advantage when it comes to play. Although mothers, once again, spend more time playing, particularly with their younger kids, their small kids, than do dads, the type of play that dads engage in with their kids is distinctive. Fathers are much more likely to engage their infants, their toddlers, and their teens in vigorous, physical, and exciting forms of play and games. Dads are more likely than moms to be found throwing their toddlers up into the air in the local park, or kicking a soccer ball with their teenage son. And this vigorous style of play is also actually popular among infants. I mentioned that Boston Children's Study before. Well, what they found in that study, when dads approached the baby, was the infants breathed more quickly, they tensed their shoulders, and their eyes widened, as if they knew something exciting was about to happen. Now, all this is important because this kind of play promotes social skills, intellectual development, and a sense of self-control. We're finding more and more about how important play is for kids' development in so many different ways. So the playful side of the dads teaches their children how to regulate their feelings and behaviors as they interact with others. We know, for instance, that engaging in rough physical play, roughhousing with dad, in the family room, say at 7:30 at night when mom is trying to get the kids to bed. This is important because it teaches kids how to deal with aggressive impulses and physical contact without losing control of their emotions. One study found that father-child rough play taught kids how to recognize others' emotions and to regulate their own emotions. Whereas Emory psychologist John Snary wrote, quote, "Children who roughhouse with their fathers usually quickly learn that biting, kicking, and other forms of physical violence are not acceptable," unquote. So kids who play more often with their dads are even more popular in school, and more generally, they are better prepared for the game of life. Dads also play a central role in pushing their kids to face the challenges and opportunities that confront them outside the home. Compared to mothers, fathers are more likely to encourage their children to take up difficult tasks, to seek out novel experiences, and to endure pain and hardship without yielding. At a young age, fathers are more likely than mothers to encourage toddlers to engage in novel activities, to engage strangers, and to be independent. As children enter into adolescence, dads are more likely to introduce their kids to the worlds of work, sports, and civil society. The bottom line here is that dads seem to excel in teaching their kids the virtues of fortitude, temperance, and prudence as they prepare for life outside the family. Or in the words of Canadian psychologist Daniel Paquette, quote, "Fathers seem to play an essential role in the empowerment of children and the opening of children to the outside world," unquote. And not surprisingly, there's considerable evidence that paternal involvement is linked to high rates of educational and occupational attainment, self-confidence, and more pro-social behavior for boys and for girls. Now, I've talked directly about how moms and dads impact their kids. I want to say something quickly about how dads indirectly impact their kids, and that is in the way in which they love the mother of their children. And we know that one of the best predictors of good mothering is having a supportive and loving husband, because women who have a good marriage are more involved with their kids, they're more nurturing of their children, and they're better at monitoring their kids. So clearly there's a way in which the love between father and mother spills over into the maternal-child relationship in ways that are beneficial to children. It's also, I think, important, too, that the relationship between mom and dad sets a kind of template for boys and for girls that will frame the way in which they approach, dating and courtship later on in life. So the boys, for instance, who see a father who loves and respects their mother are more likely to treat girls and women in a respectful and affectionate spirit. And likewise, girls who grow up in a good home are more likely to be expecting to be treated with respect and affection when they are dating or courting a boy or a man as they get older. So in all these ways, this relationship is important. It's important that dad is doing it well. Now, in terms of the kind of outcomes that we can talk about with regards to sort of gender and parenthood, the research on these kinds of questions indicates that sex-differentiated parenting has some benefits for kids. So one review of the research in child development found that kids who experienced sex-typical behavior from mom and dad, where mom was more responsive and nurturing and dad was more challenging and firm, were more competent than kids whose parents did not engage in sex-typical behavior. Another study of adolescents found that the best parenting approach was one in which moms were highly responsive and dads were highly demanding of their kids. Research on family structure is also, I think, very suggestive. In general, kids who grow up outside an intact married family are 2-3 times more likely to have serious psychological, academic, or social problems compared to kids who have just a single parent. And the general tenor, I think, of this research can be illustrated by briefly considering what we know about fatherlessness for boys and for girls. And I should say, as a parenthetical note here, that I was raised by a single mother, and maybe single mothers here today, and I want to tell you that they can do a great job of raising children. I think that my sister and I turned out pretty well. But I'm also a sociologist, and speaking kind of from a broader perspective, I want to just underline the fact that on average, generally speaking, the best place for a child is in an intact, married, biological household. So just making a distinction between recognizing there are going to be some, you know, single parents, some adoptive parents, we're also adoptive parents, my wife and I, can do a great job, but that's not the ideal. The ideal is for kids to have their intact, biological, married parents in the picture for them. So for boys, the link between crime and fatherlessness is very clear. As the former U.S. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan observed, and controversially so, but I think accurately, quote, "A community that allows a large number of young men to grow up in broken families, dominated by women, never acquiring any stable relationship to male authority, that community asks for and gets chaos," unquote. So boys learn self-control, as we've heard, from playing with and being disciplined by a loving father. They learn to control their own aggressive instincts when they see a man that they respect and love, their father, handling frustration, conflict, and difficulty without resorting to violence. By contrast, boys who do not regularly experience the love, discipline, and the modeling of a good father are more likely to engage in what we call compensatory masculinity, where they reject and denigrate all that's feminine, and instead seek to prove their masculinity by engaging in domineering, violent, and promiscuous behavior. So studies of crime give us some sense of what's happening here. So my colleague and my mentor actually at Princeton, Sarah McClanahan, did this particular study. She found that boys who are raised in single-parent homes were about twice as likely to end up spending some time in prison or in jail before they turned age 32 in the U.S. This is controlling for a host of factors like education, income, and race. And studies of crime and family patterns that look at the neighborhood or the society or community level come to similar conclusions. So as Harvard sociologist Robert Sampson said, quote, "Family structure is one of the strongest, if not the strongest, predictor of variations of urban violence across cities in the United States." But dads also matter for girls. They play an important role in, among other things, structuring the romantic and sexual lives of their daughters. Dads who are affectionate and firm with their daughters, who love and respect their wives, and simply stick around, can play a crucial role in minimizing the likelihood that their daughters will be sexually active prior to marriage or sexually active at a young age. The affection that dads bestow on their daughters makes these daughters less likely to seek attention from young men and to get involved sexually with members of the opposite sex. Fathers also protect their daughters from premarital sexual activity by setting clear disciplinary limits for their daughters, monitoring their whereabouts, and by signaling to young men that sexual activity will not be tolerated. Finally, I think this is the most fascinating thing. When they're in the home, research by University of Arizona psychology professor Bruce Ellis suggests that dads actually send a biological signal through their pheromones. And of course, these are special aromatic chemical compounds that are released by men and women. Their pheromones seem to slow the sexual development of their daughters. This in turn makes daughters less interested in sexual activity and less likely to be seen as sexual objects. So it's fascinating. What his works suggest, just as a parenthetical note, is that girls who grew up with their intact bio father and household, have the latest stages of puberty, and the girls who grew up in a single mother household have the sort of mid-range when it comes to puberty. And the girls who are raised by stepfathers or who are raised when there's a boyfriend in the home have the earliest ages of puberty. And the thinking here is that being exposed to an unrelated male seems to accelerate the sexual development of the adolescent female. That's the basic theory here that's operating. But the point is that dads matter not just socially, but they also matter, it seems to be, biologically. Actually, sorry, we'll just go back 1 second here. And you can see, So you can see here just concretely that about 5% of kids whose dads are there for their entire childhood, girls, become pregnant as teens in the U.S. Whereas if dad leaves between the ages of 6 and 18, it doubles the risk. And if dad leaves before the girl turns 6, it increases the risk by 7 times. So there's a very strong association between dad being in the home and a girl having a much lower risk of having a teenage pregnancy. We also have, and you may have heard, Elizabeth Marquardt from the Institute for American Values speak directly to this particular new report, My Daddy's Name is Donor. But I mentioned earlier in my presentation that Jennifer Aniston claimed that basically women can raise kids on their own with really no problem. And she, of course, was playing a woman who'd had a child through a sperm donor. But this new study from the Institute for American Values suggests that, you know, she's simply wrong. And that kids who were raised by single mothers through donor insemination, often, by the way, who were well-educated and relatively affluent, are more than twice as likely as young adults to report that they'd had trouble with police or law enforcement, or that they were struggling with abuse of alcohol or drugs. So it's not the case that you can kind of have a child on your own in this manner and not expect it's going to have some impact on the child that you bring into this world. So our tour de force this afternoon of the social science literature on gender and parenting indicates the following. The best psychological, sociological, I think even biological research to date suggests that on average, men and women bring different talents to the parenting enterprise. The kids benefit from having parents with distinct parenting styles. We've got to organize our families to take advantage of these distinct styles, and that family breakdown poses a serious threat to kids and to the societies within which they live. What do we do with this science? Well, I think one thing we need to do is recognize that there will be some differences in how moms and dads approach parenting. Eleanor Maccabee, the distinguished feminist psychologist at Stanford University, who once championed the idea that sex differences were caused only by socialization, now acknowledges the importance of biology in explaining sex differences in parenting. In her latest book, The Two Sexes, she concludes her study of men and women by admitting that, quote, it's probably not realistic to set a 50-50 division of labor between fathers and mothers in the day-to-day care of children as the most desirable pattern toward which we should strive as a social goal. We should consider the alternative view that equity between the sexes does not have to mean exact equality in the sense of the two sexes having exactly the same lifestyles and exactly the same allocation of time, unquote. The second thing that we need to do is to cast aside the California dreams of San Francisco and Hollywood elites and renew our appreciation for grandma's wisdom about marriage, motherhood, fatherhood, and children. Specifically, we should do more to strengthen marriage, recognizing that marriage is an institution that virtually all societies and all major civilizations have devised to ensure that kids have the benefit of being reared by their mother and their father. Let me be clear here. This is not a religious claim. This is a human claim. Marriage can be found in every major civilization in the world, precisely because every civilization in the world historically has recognized at some level that children are more likely to thrive when they have the emotional, the social, and the financial support of both their parents. So to conclude, let all of us in our own spheres, from politics to business to education to the home, do all that we can to ensure that our children have the good fortune of growing up with the man and the woman whose love brought them into this world, that is, with their own married mother and father. Thank you.